Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow with just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the CBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Thank you. Hello. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Or afternoon. Wherever you are on our planet, hello. This is Terry Smith. I'm your host, Surviving Head Trauma on the Brain Injury Radio Network. And it's that time of the month again. We meet this month to talk about the giving plant. That's the name of our episode tonight. We're going to talk about a healthy plant that's going to help the whole world if we let it grow properly. But we're going to start with saying hello to everyone around the planet, whether you're listening to us live or whether you're listening to an archive show. Wish you happiness and peace and love. And if you're listening live, you may phone the show tonight at country code 1, area code 424-243-9540. Once again, that's country code 1, area code 424-243-9540. And if you'd like to speak with our guest or ask a question or have a comment, press 1 on your keypad and I will see a little emoji go up and know that you would like to speak, and then we will bring you on the air. Meanwhile, I'd like to tell you what we're going to talk about tonight, and that is cannabis, the various forms of the cannabinoid. And we have a very special guest, someone who has researched the aspect of it that you and I probably have not considered, and is in development of so many helpful things for our community, especially with people with seizure disorder, PTSD, and a variety of other results of surviving head trauma. And his name is Mike Robinson, and he is a cancer survivor, actually, and a cannabis activist. He's the director of consumer affairs of CISBAE.com, and he's the founder of Global Cannabinoid Research Center. And Mike also is vice president of research at MBX Global Research. He's a journalist blogger at mikesmedicine.com, and the list goes on and on and on. We will bring him on the air and let him give you a little bit more of his backstory with his expertise in the topic we're discussing tonight. And after everyone eating so much today, maybe this topic will lift your energy level up a little bit and lift your ears and perk up, because it affects everyone, basically, because it's a new and upcoming thing in our country and globally even. But tonight, if you'd like to talk with us, again, the number is area code 424-243-9540. And we'd like to thank Craig, Cecilia, and Kim Justice, who run the network here, Brain Injury Radio Network. Thank you guys for keeping everything running smoothly every time we do a show. And there's a show every night of the week. You guys tune in, you'll find a host for a different type of topic every night. I'm Terry Smith, your host for Surviving Head Trauma. I'm the author of the book Surviving Head Trauma and the website terrysmithbooks.com. And on Facebook, you can find it at Surviving Head Trauma, Surviving Head Trauma seems to be the running name. And with that, I would like to introduce you to Mr. Mike Robinson, our guest. I think I see him on the switchboard. Let me check out the numbers. No, I do not. I do not have him yet. He's not on board. So we must wait for him. So while we wait, I tell you what, we will check out a song from my collection because we are not quite ready to start with him. So we'll start with some music tonight before we get into our discussion of medical cannabis. Does anybody think it's going to rain? Does it look like rain? Like Rain, Cindy Cook. You can find Cindy Cook, C-Y-N-D-I, on YouTube. Give her a check out. You might pick out one of her songs on iTunes or however you buy music these days. We have Mike on the line. We've talked about Mike. Now we have him with us live. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's nice to be here with you this Thanksgiving Eve after filling my stomach, I'm telling you. I might have eaten a little bit too much.
Well, I'm glad you stayed awake. You were able to make it for our show tonight. How are you?
Doing great, doing great. How are you tonight?
I am excited to discuss this topic because it's such a controversial one. I mean, we have some states where it's legal, some states where it's recreational, some states where it's medicinal, some are medicinal and recreational, and it seems like we can't get united in the United States on this common topic. And you've done such great background research on this as the director of consumer affairs with the Global Cannabinoid Research Center. I'm excited to hear what your perspective is and how you can educate our audience, our listening audience, on the benefits of this plant. And that's the episode title tonight, The Giving Plant. So before we get started, why don't you give us a little bit about your background? Who are you tonight so that our audience knows who we're talking with?
Well, I'm a brain injury survivor myself. You know, before traumatic head injury, I was a mortgage banker and broker and raced on a couple different professional racing tours, NASCAR sanctioned Winston West, Pro 4 West, different really fast type of race cars. And in 1995, the same day that Christopher Reeve was paralyzed, so was I. in a very high-speed impact, which is expected on the racetrack, but we don't expect to not walk away. So, you know, I am somebody that is dealing with the aftermath 23 years later of that wreck, which paralyzed me on the right side, caused severe epilepsy, caused right side blindness, an anxiety disorder, PTS, chronic pain, a plethora of different ailments that caused me at one point to be taking up to 62 pills a day. So my life was very much wrapped around the injury. It still is to a point, but it's so limited in comparison. And, you know, that's pretty much why you have me on your show. But what happened after the wreck was very intensive. I came home after a month in the hospital to find my son extremely autistic and dive deep into the world of representing children with severe disabilities in special education across the nation. I did that for about 18 years, seizing just about everywhere I went, dealing with the severe anxieties I think a lot of us are very familiar with, the inability to sleep, all the things that come with the brain injury. And, you know, as I went through all that, I tried so many different things, including medicinal marijuana, to alleviate the necessity for so many pills and to try to make life easier. I never knew that I was supposed to ingest it and not smoke it. I never knew so many different things. And as I moved through this world of being a non-attorney representative nationwide for a civil rights group that I founded for kids and people with special needs. And, you know, through all those years, I really didn't know how to get out of the position I was in. I was grateful to walk and talk. And you know, after a traumatic brain injury, I believe that we go through so many emotions, and many of us are stuck in life to where it's so hard to move on, especially in a professional way. So I felt like I was doing the best I could until I ran into what I call cannabinoid medicine. We can call it cannabis, we can call it CBD, what have you. And as I ran into that, my life changed. And as it changed, I became to a very unique position as a patient, where I was exposed to the world of compassion, the world of Dennis Ferrone, the man who actually wrote Proposition 215, which legalized medicinal cannabis in 1996 in the state of California, the first legalization in the world since the Prohibition. So I got involved with some people that generally just wouldn't get involved with, and began running a compassion program that gave away cannabis oil, treating various patients. And that went on for about 3 or 4 years until Prop 64, which the world saw, California legalized cannabis. And, you know, this really goes into a lot of what you're talking about with the state of confusion in America, where we're not united. So we watch California legalize cannabis, but most do not know that prohibited the gifting of cannabis. So what it did was shut down an operation that gave away cannabis oils to kids and adults that were in life-threatening illnesses or had chronic needs like many of us do. So I was exposed to so much, it was incredible. My world of researching law became a world of researching this plant, how it works. And I dove into that probably much deeper than I ever did dive into law. And immediately I was excluded from practicing as a non-attorney. Once I tried to file a case, the fact I used cannabis was thrown back against me, and I was disqualified. So I just got deeper and deeper into it. And as the gifting was prohibited, I had to find a safe place to land, which was the American Academy of Cannabinoid Medicine, a very well-established entity that's seeking AMA approval and approves doctors who have met the criteria and pass certain levels of education to be a cannabinoid medicine specialist. And just through being in the right place at the right time, I ended up directing that academy for a year and learning to actually write the research and present it across the nation. So I definitely have gone through a journey that's quite a bit different. During that time of being a compassion provider, I met Anne-Marie, who may know as my fiance, and Genevieve was my daughter. I basically adopted her. She just one of the kids that was in my program, and a lot of people will Google the cannabis love story, and it's really easy to look up. If people are listening and they want to know more about me or how to contact me, cannabis love story is very easy to put into your phone or computer on a Google search, and it'll bring up my blog, and it'll bring up a story that tells you quite a bit. So anyway, to wrap that all up, it's sort of a lengthy description of who I am, but now here I land at CISBEI Global, which is a corporation that is international. We're in 24 countries. We do mostly bioinnovation for big ag farming. We clean waterways, and I'm involved in that because it's the solution on a bigger level to the problems that we face across this earth that cause a lot of disabilities that are treated with cannabis medicine. MDX research, of course, researches the plant and how it works. And MDX
Wait,
grow,
did you
of course,
say problems created by cannabis?
No, well, actually, there are problems created by cannabis. I mean, there's problems created by any growth of agriculture. Anytime we grow agriculture, we take away nutrients from the land. We tend to destroy groundwater and the table water. And literally, that's what we face in our across the globe, not just in our own nation, across the globe from all of the years of agricultural farming and approved pesticide use. You have these tanks that hold pesticides that have leaked into the table water. So what I find a lot in my own research on cannabis that's growing is even people that are trying to grow organically and following all the laws to do so still will end up with plants that have trace elements of pesticides, and it's coming from the water. So, you know, what I do now, it gets very complicated and very deep and a little bit off the subject of trying to keep a little basic with cannabis medicine because, you know, like you said, we have a nation that's divided a little bit. You know, part of it is legal, part of it's not, part of it's recreational, part of it's not. And almost every patient that I know out there is very confused, and that includes farmers, people that grow. The number of people that are in the industry selling a product that will contact me and say, Mike, you know, how do I possibly dose this or maybe how do I treat that? It's an incredible number. So this is an emerging field of medicine, so new that somebody like me who has no education at all in medicine, I'm presenting next year in Brazil, in Milan. In February, I'll be in Paris for the 15th Annual Global Biomarker Summit. We just did that in Amsterdam in October. And the international community that wants the academic presentations for continued medical education for doctors, they're no longer looking to doctors to provide this information. They're looking for people that have gained the knowledge because it's so new. The endocannabinoid system itself was not discovered until 1993. So medical schools do not require any knowledge at all.
So what will your presentation cover? Well, your presentation.
They cover all, it depends on where I'm at. In August next year, for example, I'll do the sixth global conference on cancer medicine in Tokyo. I just did it in Moscow. And in Moscow, it was on CBN, which is an extract of the cannabis plant that treats cancer. So that a particular presentation was academic or called academia, and it involves an abstract. Like you see in the research, it's very complicated. It's very scientific. So on one end of the step, I'll do that and go out and present scientifically so it teaches doctors, because we've got so many problems, and how do we come up with a solution? Patients go to their doctor and ask them, what do I do? I'm using cannabis, and the doctor says, well, there's not enough research. So one of my solutions is get out there and do the research, present the research. So doctors really can't say that, because people can say, well, I talked to Mike Robinson, or I heard him on the air, and I went and read the cannabis love story, you know, and I see where this guy used to work, and I Googled him and saw some research, so I guess there is research. So there's so many different problems that we face as patients. They're so confusing that they have to be handled one by one, and one of them is getting enough current cutting-edge research out there to doctors and getting doctors to pay attention to it.
Because half the country is legal, half the country is illegal. But we have the same scientific research available to where it's legal. So why can't the states where it's illegal just use the same information? What's the problem? Is there a political or big pharma?
Do you want the truth?
That's what I like, yeah.
Okay, you want the bold truth? Okay. Let's look at prohibition itself quickly, okay? Prohibition occurred in 1937. The Marijuana Tax Act was brought into the Senate literally with no notice. The AMA did not know it was even happening. There were 52 medications on the shelves of pharmacy that came from cannabis extracts. In 1937, when people say prohibition occurred, it did not occur. What occurred was the Marijuana Tax Act, which stopped hemp farmers from growing. Of course, the conspiracy on this one is simple. Hemp was basically taking the paper industry and turning it into nothing. So in order for William Rand Paul first and many others to deforest places like Oregon, they needed hemp to be somehow taxed to the point that it wouldn't be grown like it once was. Because in 1837, the laws were very basic. Part of our Constitution required the growth of hemp on your property. So literally what happened over a 100-year period of time exactly was the requirement to grow and then a taxation act. And this taxation act happens in 1937 on marijuana. So the public at large had no clue that the cannabis tincture they were taking that said cannabis sativa or cannabis indica on the bottle, they had no clue that this was tied to this marijuana that was being taxed. The AMA went in and gave 17 hours of testimony opposing the taxation of hemp and opposing any type of prohibition of cannabis at all, and prohibition was not enacted. Another 5 years, up to 1 million prescriptions per year were written for cannabis tinctures, up until 1942 when it was completely cut off. And it was completely cut off because people didn't want it by 1942. With the Reefer Madness campaign going against the very trusting public, I mean, let's think about this. After World War I, there wasn't enough metal for bombs or for shells for the guns. So many people that know a little history on this know that people gave up their wedding rings. They gave up their necklaces. They gave up their family heirlooms and their silver, all to make bombs for their own country. This is how much America trusted their government back in these days. So a very willing public was willing to trust the government all the way through everything they had to say. All these blames of the darkies bringing in the cannabis. It had to be Mexicans. It had to be. It was continually marginalizing people that were already marginalized. It was the use of propaganda to make a plant look bad, and all the way through, it's all been one lie. Our government is very aware that we know it was a lie. In 1947, there was a study done on 11 epilepsy patients that approved cannabis worked. 7 of those patients stopped seizing. And this study has been spread far and wide. I mean,
Why the lie?
Big pharma. And you know, when I say big pharma, I'm now talking myself. because in order to stay up with what's going on right now, you better have something going on biochemically. You better be looking at replacing some of the garbage that's being made, and just like the recent CBD that was released. That's why I have a job at CISPE, because I wrote research about it and exposed the truth. I mean, there's a lot of garbage that comes from Big Pharma. People are demanding the end of prohibition right now, and not looking at the fact that THC is Schedule 3 today. It was in 1985 when Marinol was approved. So synthetic THC could be written on prescription and has been. I have one in my refrigerator for THC at any given time by any given doctor, completely legal under Schedule 3. So this has been going on for a long time, but what hasn't been going on is a populace that's awake. People did not have social media in 1985 to see that Marinol, a THC substance, was approved under Schedule 3. But they most certainly had it.
But Marinol is
doesn't
synthetic.
Matter. It's synthetic, but it's still THC. So THC itself is Schedule 3. Now people can argue whether or not Epidiolex, which was just released by GW Pharma, is or is not synthetic CBD, but it's Schedule 5, and it's a plant extract. So the difference between 1985 and 2018 is the Internet. People now know that, hey, this plant extract coming from GW Pharma, synthetic or not, is Schedule 5, and it's cannabis. So the lie to keep cannabis illegal is very simple. The cost of chemotherapy, I mean, I am a 5-time cancer patient now as of last week. I'd already beat 4 different cancers, 3 of them.
All right. Good for you.
Three of them at stage 4 or low. And, you know, prostate, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Hodgkin's lymphocytic. Those are all down, and now I just found out it's multiple myeloma, which is in the blood. It's a little more aggressive, but I've been already treating it. This is why. I mean, a cancer treatment, your average chemo visit is $5,000. You know, so if somebody's going to chemotherapy, what, a couple times a week, several times a month, how much does that cost? How much money is there in an industry created to do nothing more than decimate every single blood cell you have? Chemotherapy does not target anything, and our government knows very clearly, because anybody can go look on YouTube and actually see the scientific videos, THC kills cancer cells only. It doesn't kill other cells. It targets cancer cells and kills them. And if anybody doesn't believe that, pick up your phone, go to YouTube, THC killing cancer cells. Just put that in there.
What about
what you're
going to
watch is a live video of it. CBD now, okay, this is very interesting. The cancer that I'm dealing with right now is a blood cancer, and CBD itself does, coming from the whole plant, because when you talk about CBD, does it come from industrial hemp? Is it CBD isolate? Does it come from CBD buds, big juicy buds that look like they're THC? I mean, this is why I call it a state of confusion. When people ask about what state's legal, what state's not, I'm like, yeah, every state is a state of confusion, because there's so many questions to be answered that just aren't for the patient, and it's very confusing. So CBD in itself, coming from the plant, the bud extracted, that I will use. Coming from industrial hemp turned into isolate, which is like a fine powder, then added to another substance in a carrier, that I do not use. And that's because of my own knowledge through research. Now, is it not helpful? I believe it's all helpful. Depending on what you're treating, because, you know, we're all looking at something different that we're treating. But CBD in the treatment of cancer, it's definitely known to be an antigen, which means it shrinks tumors. It cuts off the blood supply to a tumor, so it cannot grow anymore.
Right.
So it's definitely...
Mike, you know what? Before you get started there, we're at the bottom of the hour. It's time for a music break. But I want to leave us with what what cannabis can heal, things that it can reach. So after our music break, we're going to come back and have you answer that for us. So meanwhile, while you're listening to this music, get your pen out and write down area code 424-243-9540. If you have a question for Mike or anything about cannabis tonight, give us a call. Press 1 on your phone, and I'll see a little emoji on the switchboard go up, and I'll bring you on the air and let you ask live. Meanwhile, we're going to play Cindy Cook again. Rise to the occasion. Cindy Cook, C-Y-N-D-I-C-O-O-K. Look her up on YouTube. Cindy Cook, rise to the occasion.
Hold me, no hesitation.
look, rise to the occasion. And the occasion tonight is the plant that gives, the giving plant. That's tonight's episode. And we are Surviving Head Trauma with Terry Smith. I'm Terry Smith, your host. And we're on the Brain Injury Radio Network, brought to you tonight by Kim Justice and Craig Cecilia. Thank you guys for bringing us on the airwaves and getting our voice out there. Good morning, afternoon, or good evening, whether you are on this planet. Hello, whether you're listening live or to an archived show. We're back with Mike tonight, Mike Robinson, and we're going to continue from where we were before the music break and talk about the benefits of cannabis. There's so many, Mike. Where would you start as one of the biggest benefits from a variety of the plant?
I would say the biggest benefit to the plant itself is that it begins to take over the same actions as so many pharmaceuticals. It's incredible. The plant has the ability to surpass the ability of pharmaceutical medicines as we know them in a pretty spectacular way. Cannabis itself comes from a genus of plants called the Cannabaceae that has 172 different flowering and fruiting plants, seeded plants, including the huckleberry plant. The four strains of four types of cannabis that all the strains come from are only exactly that, four of those different plants. But what's very, very unique about the cannabis plant is that it contains the terpenes of all 172 plants. So it's almost like having doTERRA or Young Living, you know, those kind of terpene oils that a lot of people use and rely on. It's like having all of them all in one plant, bam. So above and beyond the abilities that the cannabinoids bring for relaxing people and calming them, if they're going through anxiety or stress or PTSD or having migraine headaches or pain, or going a little bit further to handling cancers. I myself had chronic Lyme disease and did not know when I was treating myself for severe epilepsy. I had no clue that all the oil I was using was killing the Lyme disease that I had for over two decades. So this is how incredible the plant is. It was known for stopping nausea, for glaucoma. So when we look at that all the way back to 30, 40 years ago, even further when, you know, and this is still going on today, the U.S. government program that hands out actual plant material. There's still eight recipients getting joints in the mail every month with glaucoma. Okay, and that it relieves pressure, which means it's one of the strongest anti-inflammatory medications on this planet. And it answers the question why it remains a Schedule I substance, why it remains out of the reach of people, because it will replace over-the-counter medications. The opioid receptors are literally in the endocannabinoid system. This is why you're seeing such a huge move from pain medication over to cannabis medication. And the list just goes on and on from lupus to CRS or CRPS to MS, MD, and it just goes on, CP, all types of childhood genetic disorders. My daughter Genevieve with severe autism and epilepsy, it really gets her life back again. I mean, the list is so long, it's incredible. And this is, of course, why we're dealing with these crazy regulations, and it's why we're not seeing a lift of the federal prohibition of the plant under Schedule I. We're seeing these ludicrous things happen, such as plant medications come onto the pharmaceutical market, recreational laws in different states. We're seeing all these crazy actions go on while the plant remains a Schedule I next to LSD and heroin.
And so you're saying that greed, is that what you're saying, that greed is the driving force to keep it illegal in the states that haven't come to the light yet?
huge driving force to keep it federally illegal. Because what you have to look at is the Controlled Substances Act of 1970 by Richard Nixon, which made this a Schedule I substance, was presented to the UN. Governments around the world, the globe, were misled by America with prohibition in the first place. They were misled by the Reefer Madness. They were misled again in the 70s. They were misled again in the late 90s when OxyContin and OxyCodone were allowed in our market, and heroin was reintroduced into our pharmacopoeia, where people could once again buy or get a prescription that they could melt down and shoot up as heroin. So there's been so many misleading things that have happened, and cannabis remains next to these drugs that it should never be next to. Methamphetamine and cocaine are Schedule II. So this shows you, in my opinion, it's crimes against humanity. We have a government in the United States that goes out and blows up other countries left and right over crimes against humanity, and we kill innocent children and people in those wars. I mean, let's face it, look, this happens. And right in our own country, in the United States, we've got people seizing to death. We've got people dying of cancer while this crime against humanity called prohibition is perpetuated upon everybody. And our population of people...
The state's growing, though. It seems as if state by state we're seeing become legal. What was the latest one in the Northeast and New England somewhere just passed it?
Yeah,
made it legal?
I can't keep up, you know. And see, as we see the legalization... One message I spread to people quickly is because people get excited with legalization, and I love that excitement. I don't want to step on it at all. But the one thing I remind people is the framework for the regulations, for the actual awarding of grows, for the awarding of dispensaries. It only takes about 2 years. So you see legalization, and then you see it take a couple of years, then you see capitalization occur. And I'm somebody that's so deep in this that I know extractors, I know growers, I know the price of everything. I know that it takes maybe, I know that for about $3 or $4 a gram, I can extract 90, 97% THC out of plants, for example, or 92% CBD out of plants for $3 or $4 a gram. That's 1,000 milligrams. If you go out and look at CBD on the market right now, a 1,000 milligram bottle of something is somewhere between $79 and $150, and the raw product I could grab for $3 to $5 cost maximum. You know, so
it's an incredible markup.
What's happened? An incredible markup, and there's a reason for it, because there's regulation that's beyond any form of belief. And it's the government has basically put cannabis in a whole different class than it's put what we eat. Literally, when we look at what's in a grocery store, we go into a grocery store with the expectation that everything's clean, everything's good for us, and it's not true. But when we look at cannabis, we're all suspect about it, but it's under such heavy regulation that nothing can be sold without it being 20 times cleaner than an apple or a pear that you buy.
I have a question for you. Some states allow the actual plant to be sold. You can actually buy the bud itself. In other, like Florida, for example, you can only buy the oil or the patch or the pill, but you can't actually buy the bud itself, only the oil extracts. And explain why it's divided that way, what makes one more legal than the other, selling the plant versus the oil?
It's nonsensical. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. It's a delay feature. When you make it only the oil first, then you get more lobbying money. The number one income in the world of cannabis is real estate. The number two, almost tied for number one, is legal fees. These are the two biggest areas where money is made in this huge, almost $20 billion industry. You know, so if you think about it, if you make it to where there's only oil approved because it sounds better politically, this horrid plant that was called devil's lettuce can't be approved, but the oil extract, you know, that's great. It's the same thing. So why not let the people grow their own plant, make their own oil? It's control. And it's very much a delay. In my opinion, that would be the very best answer. It's a delay. Let's take a little bit longer. Let's let the pharmaceutical companies make a little bit more money while they figure out their formulations for more plant medicine.
So what's it going to take to get the federal government to change its position? I mean, even the states that have legalized it still face that as a danger, a cloud over their state, if you will.
Well,
is that going to happen? Do you see a federal change?
Well, oh, definitely. I see it happening. I mean, we've got no choice. On one side of the fence, you've got Canada that's ended prohibition. How did they end it? By giving regulation to the government. Okay, so in order to get prohibition ended, to get legalization for everybody, regulation is going to have to occur. And it's coming. When you look at 30 states with different laws that allow cannabis of some type, whether it be CBD, whether it be the plant grown, recreational, medicinal, you know, whatever it may be, you've got 30 different sets of laws. This makes the federal government nervous because there's literally 30 different rules that apply. Now, what Canada did was very simple. There's just one rule, the government's rule. And if we had that in the United States, as much as I oppose any type of control, I believe that we would see an end to the mass state of confusion. We would see a supply chain that extends to everybody in every state legally. We would see interstate commerce. But see, these are the things that are being blocked right now by the federal government, interstate commerce. So California, which can grow enough cannabis for everybody in the nation, can't ship it out. So these are the blockades that are being done by our federal government that stop people from treating anxiety or treating seizures, because, I mean, it's an incredible thing. I have to tell you, to just be on your show and talking about this and think about the achievements of the last 12 months alone that would have never happened without cannabis as my medicine. I wouldn't be alive. Cancer would have killed me years ago. I don't know if I'd be walking. I used to sneeze all the time. And when I think about this, it's my driving force. You know, it's the number one reason I do what I do is to look at, number one, the director of consumer affairs, my position is 100% to look at what's good for the consumer and what's not, even though our corporation does not sell a single thing. So as far as, you know, cannabis oils or anything like that. But I mean, all of this is, to me, to look at gaining access for everybody. And how we're going to have to do it is concessions people don't want to make. People want to see the end of prohibition completely. They want to see it completely over. And I agree. But that just doesn't happen.
From what you're saying, it sounds to me as what you're saying is that until Big Pharma has the way of getting its hand on every penny and every don't become a federal change or united front in every state legal. So we need,
well, you know, guess
somehow
what? I have news for people. For a lot of the population that's not deep into this, they don't know what's going on, and a lot of the population that is doesn't know what's going on. Right now, Big Pharma does have their hands so heavily down the rabbit hole of cannabinoid medicine. It's incredible, with over 500 patents issued for different cannabinoid medicines that are being worked on. R&D, research and development, is underway with so many biomedical companies. It's incredible. After writing a lot of research, one of those pieces being about Epidiolex and the GW Pharma CBD that's been released and the dangers within it, I mean, I had to write about it. I have epilepsy. It's an epilepsy medication that can cause seizures. So I had to sort of warn my people, so to say. But after writing this article and having it sort of go big and be published internationally, the number of offers that came into my email from biopharm companies wanting to work together, wanting to collaborate, or having actually come and work for them to create a medication. It wasn't one or two or one or two dozen. We're talking 50, 60 different offers. And it's just an incredible thing to see this mad rush to create what's already there. I mean, we have a plant that grows easily. That's why it's called weed.
Well, you know what? For it to have been around for so long and for the patents to have dated so far back, why haven't they come forth sooner? What's the slowdown? Why are they being held up so long?
These are new patents. I'm talking about in the last couple, like in the last 3 years, there's over 500 patents. We have one patent. We look at one patent heavily from, I believe, 2003, I believe. That's cannabinoids as neuroprotectants and antioxidants. Okay, so when we talk on this show, we're talking about a government that has patented the plant for 15 years now, holds the patent, and then releases out patents under its own patent. And who owns patent number 663-0507, which you can put right into Google again, and it blows your mind when you take a look at this patent owned by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So our government...
How do you patent cannabis? You patent various extracts or various components of its extract?
This would be a question for the U.S. government under trial. You know, this would be a question with our Senate all under oath answering a bunch of questions. I mean, how do you patent something as a medicine 15 years ago and keep it as a Schedule I substance away from the people that need it as medicine, including all of us with traumatic brain injuries? Okay, because this is medicine that makes me capable of doing what I do. I just spent 8 days in Vegas, keynote speaker at multiple events. At one day I was in three different hotels at three different events on the stage, and I was able to handle that pre-stage anxiety, the trips that I take on Amtrak because I can't drive from epilepsy, and even the Greyhound, and you know the crowds that come with it. Cannabis medicine is what made me able to deliver the message on cannabis medicine.
Answer the question I was leading to. I was just about to ask you, with you doing so much speaking around the planet, how do you face, because I realize after traumatic brain injury, sometimes confronting a large crowd like that can be somewhat overwhelming. So you're saying that cannabis is your aid to help you get the message across?
Well, it most definitely is. I'm a former race car driver, so you know, I facing a fear is something I've done in the past in a big way, and you know, but when it comes to publicly speaking, it's a whole different world. I mean, sometimes I'm speaking to doctors in academia, and it's continued medical education credits that they're gaining, they're learning in an educational symposium. So the speech has to be very accurate. It comes with slides. It comes with an abstract and a scientific study that's written. So it takes a lot of work, a lot of effort. It's a lot of stress. And I definitely use more cannabis medicine. I always use ingested oils. They work by far the best for me. Everybody is different, and everybody responds to cannabinoids differently. Some people can't take a whole lot of THC. Some people are like me and are THC-driven, which poses a problem, you know, because you're traveling to different places. So for me, I'm always lining up what's going to be there when I get there. And, you know, I go through a lot that I wouldn't have to go through if we could just tell the truth as a government and say, look, we know this stuff is medicine. We're allowing it to be distributed in pharmacies now as medicine once again. And, you know, to answer the question in the best way, I believe that we will see the end of prohibition and the ability for everybody to grow a few plants when we have the same number of medicines again that we had back when they did the Marijuana Tax Act. When we have 50 medicines or so on pharmacy shelves that are made with cannabis extracts, there's CBN is one that's not talked about a lot, and for many of us, cannabidiol or CBN is way better than THC or CBD. I mean, for me, that's what I use, and literally all it is overheated THC. oxidizes and breaks down and turns into a different extract. It's very calming.
Well, Mike, let me ask you this. Is the simplicity of simply growing a plant the fear that Big Pharma has, that they can't control somebody growing from a seed their own medicine? They can't dictate how you get access to the product since it's so easily grown in your own backyard?
If you can grow just like you grow tomatoes and then take those tomatoes and make sauce, okay, you can grow cannabis and take the cannabis plant and infuse it into something like MCT coconut oil like I do and use it as your medicine. I mean, my medicine is so cheap, it's incredible. It doesn't cost that much money to take cannabis and infuse it into something like MCT coconut oil. And
right, that's my question.
May not like it. I mean, one of those 10 ml tubes of oil that you see on the market for several hundred dollars, it costs me like $5 to make that. And anybody else that's able to grow it only costs maybe $5 or $10. That's the most to make that. And you know, it's something healthy. It's something that replaces my medicines. I take today 6 pills a day. I used to take 62. So how
62.
Much profit did I take away by 56 pills
from
a
Big
day?
Pharma. All right.
From Big
well,
Pharma,
Mike, listen.
You're talking about a lot of pills.
Let's hold that thought for 30 seconds, and let's go back to how many pills you took or eliminated with the use of cannabis. 30 seconds. We'll be right back.
5.3 million Americans living with traumatic brain injuries want the same things we all want. A good job, someone to love, a nice home, and fun in their lives. They're not alone. The Brain Injury Association of America wants to remind you that March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. For information about brain injury and how you can help raise awareness, visit the Brain Injury Association of America at www.biausa.org.
BIAUSA.org, Brain Injury Association of America. If you need help near you, wherever you are in the United States, you can find a local chapter near you. Mike, we're talking about where were we? What were we saying?
There's just so much to
benefit.
Say.
Yeah, we've got so much to cover here. There's so much. But you know what? I want to get back to you said something earlier when you started it. About being a race car driver and how that was your first head injury. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, we like to talk about that on the show, how people acquire their head injuries. Were you racing at the time or were you driving?
Yeah,
what
so
was
I was racing
situation?
At the time. The situation was going really fast and turning left. You know, it's sort of a joke that we have around the racetrack. You know, you go fast, turn left. You know, it's the thing you got to do when you're on the circle track. And I was racing on a very tight track. And, I don't go heavily into the subject because it's something I'm writing about right now. And I'll be going much, much deeper into all of it. But it did happen in a race. And it was something that just didn't have to happen. And I think we all look at our head injuries, you know, we have all these different emotions that pop out when we talk about it. And here it is, you know, in 2018, and when I talk about 1995, when I talk about May 29th, you know, 1995, Memorial Day, and what happened that day, it still brings that emotion to me. I was at the top of my world. I was a mortgage banker, mortgage broker, and multiple different mortgage companies and a finance company. I lived in a very nice, expensive home. I drove a new vet. My ex-wife at the time had a BMW and a Mercedes in the garage. Life was great. I was on tour in a race, and You know, just the call was made for clearance, which just means make the pass, and the pass wasn't there. You know, a car that was lapped got in the way, basically. You know, when you're down several laps, you're supposed to pull out of the way when one of the leaders is coming around you, and the car didn't. So I could blame it on that car or not blame it at all, and I find that no blame at all is the best way to look at it. It just happened, and suddenly I was in the wall so quickly, it was incredible. The bolts to the seat broke, but the bolts to the harness did not, which caused quite a bit of bodily injuries. My head went up into the cage, and it took quite a bit of work to get me out of there.
How fast are you going?
Nearly 200 miles an hour.
Nearly 200 so, miles an hour?
About 181 miles an hour on the clock. So with impact, not only there would be no survival, at that high of an impact, the car popped about 5 feet up off the track. The front clip was torn away, and another car gathered up at about nearly 100 miles an hour and T-boned me. It was buried up underneath the car. I was metaphorically away, and there was no thought of survival. You know, I came back in a wheelchair nearly 6 months later, you know, out of the hospital, and it was just a stigma to the crowd. You know, I think a lot of us go through this. You know, when we have a head injury, the people that we knew before it don't understand the emotions that we're going through it. And the stress that puts on us as we're trying to heal is incredible. You know, we're trying to survive. And at the same time, we're also trying to get the world around us to understand that, hey, some of these thoughts we're having, we can't control. Some of our moods and tempers we can't control, and they're more than just minor, and I think that that survival mechanisms kick in, and people go one way or another after a traumatic brain injury that we either fight our way out and continue fighting, and that's. Thankfully, the way I had to look at it, my son couldn't speak. I left and my son was fine. I came back and my son was severely autistic. I had to do something. I didn't have a choice. You know, if I in the hospital, I admit, I tried to actually get the one of the intubation tubes up around my neck. I didn't even want to be alive. You know, I couldn't drive anymore. I knew I was paralyzed. I couldn't talk. You know, all these things happen and my choice was to survive, and it's been my choice.
So you overcame your paralysis. How long did it take you to regain your ability to walk?
It took nearly 2 years to be able to walk without any assistance. And it was short-lived due to cancer. You know, and by 98, I was walking well. By 99, I was, you know, walking really good. But, you know, early 2000, I was surfing and moved to Hawaii. And in 2003, I got cancer for the first time, had chemo and radiation, and I did not know that chemotherapy can reinduce any previous stroke or paralysis. And my right side went numb again after about 6 treatments. And, you know, so I at that time, allowed them to cut out the cancer. And nowadays, I know that the cutting out the cancer part was probably enough, and I wouldn't even do that today. I would treat myself with cannabis oils. You know, it would kill the cancer cells. It would shrink the small lymph nodes. I would not need invasive surgery. I would not need to invade my immune system. Instead, cannabis is known to strengthen the immune system. It's literally a superfood. A person can stay alive eating the raw plant, taking oil. You wouldn't even need food. You've got all the omegas possible. You've got calories. You've got fats. it's just an amazing plant. So,
well, I'll tell you what is amazing. It's amazing to have you talk with us after hearing your story. Crashing at nearly 200 miles an hour, 180 plus miles an hour, and surviving. That's quite a story. I mean, have you thought of pinning a a book behind surviving such an impact? That's not something many people
yeah.
walk away from.
Well, you know, I was always busy. You know, I've been busy since then. Yeah, you know, when I delved deep in the world of autism for my son, I started representing other kids. I saw a problem with timeout cells, the illegal use of restraint and seclusion in schools throughout the United States, a severe injustice upon children with severe disabilities. But the need to close those timeout rooms became overwhelming. It pretty much ate up all my time. And then once the cannabis stuff started, you know, when you're working compassion, that becomes number one. If I wasn't on the phone talking in this interview with you, that's likely what I'd be doing is answering somebody's question about what they need. You know, nowadays, I can't always give everybody what they want, and rarely can I do that at all. But because I look at it on a different level, you know, so it's just a, you know, it can become overwhelming, you know, all of it.
So let me ask you this: you started with the race, the car racing, and crashing it off at 180 plus miles per hour, and then having cancer shortly after that, and then having to deal with your son who's autistic, and you're trying to hold it all together with a family. What would you recommend
to
someone?
Didn't hold together.
Yeah,
it didn't hold together.
Someone,
the family fell apart
someone,
immediately. You know, divorce
well,
was immediate.
Someone,
I think that happens to many of us.
Well, someone new
well,
right
I mean,
now listening who just happened to them, or someone in their family, and they're at a stage of confusion, not knowing how to handle this new person. How did you get through all that and contain yourself and balance it all? Was it the plant, the giving plant?
Well, you know, I always smoked cannabis. I through all of it. Right after the wreck, I smoked cannabis. Before the wreck, I smoked cannabis. It's proven to be a neuroprotectant. So if you think about that and the fact that I smoked cannabis for 15 years before I wrecked, you know, the plant itself has proved to protect the brain from injury. My brain was injured in a way that should have killed me. And how did I deal with it post-wreck was incredible. It was hard. Getting people to understand me and the new me was incredibly hard because I went from being a very harsh, concise mortgage banker, you know, very, very brash race car driver type to being a confused person, unsure of myself, you know, going through emotional, you know, even fits, if you want to call them that. I mean, you know, we've been through it. You know, people with traumatic brain injuries know what I'm talking about. You know, we go through this finding ourselves again thing, and a lot of times who we find wasn't the person we once were. I would say all the time who we find isn't the person we once were. And the stress and all that, I did use cannabis back when it was illegal. I smoked it. Once it was legal, I got a card. You know, and smoked it then. And I think after the wreck, it was always legal because in California, I had Prop 215. I never knew I'd end up, you know, writing the Perone resolution for the guy that wrote Prop 215, Dennis Perone. But it always was something that helped me. But I never knew until one day on September 8th, 2013, until I seized at night, the night before, and fell out of bed that morning, tearing an ab muscle. I never knew I was supposed to ingest the plant. And, you know, I tear this ab muscle, and this is an intense story. I tear the ab muscle, and here I am. I smoke cannabis, and I weigh about 315 pounds. Like, I'm way overweight. I weigh 110 pounds more than I weigh today. And I'm, like, just unhappy. I'm taking 64 pills a day. I have severe epilepsy, chronic pain, chronic Lyme disease. You know, I'm blind in the right eye, which I see out of now. Cannabis brought vision back to my eye. It was legally blind. My Social Security award, I'm legally blind still, but I'm not. I can see. It's still under the, you know, parking. So all this is going on, and I'm just not a happy guy. I've got this torn rib, or not rib, ab muscle in my stomach from the seizure, And I refused to go to the hospital by the ambulance and end up going to ER on my own. They do an ultrasound and tell me, you know, you've got a big tear in your six-pack. You know, one of your top muscles has a tear in it that's bilateral. You're going to need surgery. So I leave there. I don't even stay. And I can't eat. I figure I'll go home and smoke. I can't smoke. I cough, and it bulges. And this Korean roommate I have, cousin tells me, Michael-san, his name was Henry, but we called him Henry, but his name was Fu Wong Chang. And nobody could pronounce his name right or get it right, so we called Fu, we called him Henry. And Henry comes to me, he was a chiropractor and made Chinese herbal medicine. And he came to me and said, Michael-san, come eat it all. And I'm like, I know, Henry, I can't eat. Every time I try to eat, it bulges. And then, you know, I can't smoke. I'm like eating the cannabis raw. And I didn't know at that time what I know today as a researcher that I was eating THCA. I was eating raw terpenes. I was eating awesome medicine. And I didn't know that. All I thought was like eating something, trying to get high, okay, trying to relax. And he comes and gives me this bottle of Chinese herbs. And I'm like, I don't want your Chinese herbs. You know? He's like, you can't eat it all, Michael-san. Can you? Well, come to find out, after 3 days of him going on and on about this stuff, it's cannabidiol, he's trying to tell me. Michael-san, cannabidiol, CBD. So it's literally been like, I think almost close to a week, because I talk about this on a video on YouTube, and I realized I hadn't been sleeping. And I looked at the can-eat-it-all stuff, and I was so sick of hearing about it. I threw it in the garbage. I was like, I'm taking like five of these at a time. They're bloating my stomach up. I mean, I don't really know what they're doing. And I threw it in the garbage, and he came and pulled them out and wrote down. And I told him, I just don't want to hear it anymore. About this, can't eat it all. And he writes down C-A-N-N-A. And I'm looking over his shoulder like, wait a minute. This is cannabis? Cannabidiol? So I go to my computer and put it in, and up pops Charlotte, the little girl in Colorado, you know. Charlotte's Web, Charlotte pops up, and the story about her. And research is there. So here I am, a legal researcher that has to look up case law, you know, for cases I'm working on. I drop everything. I'm up all night that night researching this stuff, eating these little pellets left and right. And my life has been different ever since that night, ever since that guy who wasn't even an American citizen, he's back in Korea now. Since
how did you run into it? How did you find it? Chance running into him?
I was in an expensive part of Southern California, and the only way to live there was at a four-bedroom, three-bath. It was owned by an attorney that I'd worked with. He said, hey, look, Mike, take this over, rent the rooms out, and it'll pay your rent. And so that's what I was doing, was renting out the rooms and living in the master bedroom and just working out of my master bedroom as my home office. And he was one of my room renters.
So he turned you on to it then. So that leads us to our next question. Well, that's what I'm saying. So you were young and open. What about for our audience members who might be not necessarily even older, maybe younger, but just more conservative and a bit leery because of the propaganda we talked about earlier? How do you talk to them and tell them that? What's that?
I mean, we're talking 5 years ago.
Well, I'm talking now, today. How do we get them to open up and relax a little bit to try something new? Do you have any wisdom to share to get them to open up and give it a try? Because of the propaganda they've been fed so long that it's so bad for them after we've seen evidence
and scientific
proof. First of
all, let's think about the propaganda. As a researcher, I have to state something very clearly. There's a lot of research out there that's called targeted research. So that's done specifically to send a message, to sell a product. It's research done by an independent researcher who's gaining a grant from somebody. They want another grant because that's how they keep their thing going, right? Okay, so a lot of it is done by NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse. Okay, so cannabis is one thing with heroin. It gets the same Schedule I attention as heroin does. Even though heroin you can get at the drugstore via oxycodone, OxyContin, and a list of 20 other Roxaset, on and on and on and on and on, fentanyl patches, you know what I mean, hydrocodone, Vicodin. Totally legal to give a job stuff, you know. So when we look at this, we've been fed a big load of lies. And people are nervous about using the plant, smoking the plant. And if they never have, they should be a little bit. There is something called cannabinoid hypermesis syndrome, which means that some people actually can't tolerate very well. You know, some people can actually even get sick. You know, so overusing is not a great thing. It, just like anything else, there's abuse. Cannabis is a great medicine. But when we say medicine, there's use of medicines and there's abuse of medicines.
Oh, now, we've never heard of anyone ODing on medicine, on marijuana. So when you say abuse, how do you abuse it?
You've never heard of that. Nobody's ever ODed and died documented. But you've never heard of an OD death. I, on the other hand, am pretty deep in this. And there are multiple diagnostics for people that do too many dabs, which are concentrated THC, which is inhaled all at one time. I use dabs in very small amounts, and people abuse it. So, again, if say you've got 1,000 milligrams or a gram of a concentration and you're going to vaporize it, which is called dabbing, do you do all 1,000 milligrams at once or do you do 10 milligrams at once? One is use, one is abuse. And it doesn't matter. Anything you get that's great is going to have abuse factors. Cannabis is an awesome, awesome medication. It's an awesome plant. It's an awesome herb. It's got great benefits. But to say that there's no negative effects would be a lie. It would be a total, complete lie. Some people can't handle THC at all. Some people get more anxiety from THC and do better with CBD. Other people don't get any effect that's good at all from CBD. They get very anxious like I do. And they need THC to calm them down, a combination of both. Some people smoke and vape and use oil. I do. Some people only use a few drops of oil. So what we have are individual physiologies. Everybody's different. So when we look at big pharma, and the problems with pharmaceutical medication. Generally, the biggest problem is it's a one-size-fits-all thing. Nobody's looking at doctors. They got 15 to 10 minutes for you. They're going to write out a prescription real quick. They're not looking at your individual physiology. You're not getting to take a pill that's 10 milligrams and push it out a tube slowly a little bit at a time to see how it works on you. You're just taking the whole 10 milligrams. So when you think about the anxiety people have in taking cannabis, if they just move that anxiety away and considered how they take pharmaceuticals blindly, just blindly take what this doctor ordered for them, not knowing if there's a contraindication, something they shouldn't take with it, not knowing if a dietary thing shouldn't be taken with it, not knowing all kinds of things because doctors make a lot of errors. Like with me.
Especially with the opioid crisis we're having. We're living through a crisis right now with the opioid crisis. That's a good incentive to try something new.
It's a dual-edged sword. The opioid crisis goes two ways. There's a crisis in which we need to cut down the overuse of opioids. There's also a crisis in which people that are in a lot of serious pain now can't get their medicine because a bunch of people overuse drugs, abuse them, sold them to their friends, on and on and on and on. And then the government decided, hey, we're going to look good now after making opioids one of the number one things prescribed because that's what we pushed everybody into. So literally, I mean, if we look at the reality of this, we wouldn't have an opioid crisis if our government wouldn't have just followed the Say No to Drugs campaign that although people don't like Nancy Reagan for this, we definitely don't like what she did with cannabis under it, but she said no to oxycodone and OxyContin. She would not allow it in 1987. In 1996, it was brought back by Purdue Pharma to the Clinton administration, who let it right through. So literally, we brought heroin back into the marketplace. We created the opioid crisis. And now we look good by trying to fight it. And in doing so, what happens in that dual-edged sword is, yes, we replace opioids with cannabis because that's easy, but we've got people that have cancer pain and other pains that literally are dying anyway. And they want their medicine, and they should be able to get their medicine. They should not be delayed. And I'm not talking for myself. I quit this stuff. But there's people that I talk to all the time. They're like, Mike, you know, I hear this nature not chills thing, and I hear you talking about quitting your meds, and I'm all for it, but without them, I couldn't survive. I couldn't make it through the day. And I'm in an illegal state, and even if I was legal, I don't know where I'd get the oil or when. And, you know, so we have to look at everything practically. And when I talk about this, you can see how the big lie with cannabis is there. I mean, people are so afraid to try something right now that will work well for them, but they were very quick to grab an oxycodone or a Percocet or something like that after a dental procedure and didn't think even twice about the fact that they were taking a derivative of heroin.
Well, the thing now is that even if you're not in a legal state where you can actually get a controlled derivative of the plant, not derivative, but of an actual component of the plant, if you live in an illegal state and you still have to get it underground, there's an influx now of fentanyl and people are dying from buying it off the street and in the underground. So that's another problem that's being born.
And when we look at that problem, it comes from the same thing. As the laws are tightened on prescribing opioids, there's going to be a push over into a black market where people go to it that can't get their pills and eventually turn into heroin addicts. That's just a fact. You take away somebody's oxycodone, not everybody can sit and sweat it. I wrote a blog. I was up at 4 a.m. 10 days into quitting, oxycodone given to me for bone metastasis. The type of cancer that I have is in your bone marrow, it's in your blood, and it tends to eat at bones. So my collarbone's got a couple of spots that are ate at, and it's a tad painful. Okay. And
how did you detect it?
It was detected in, it's easily detected in an x-ray. It's that simple to see.
Okay.
But I detected it through pain and cracking. I mean, because you get internal fractures and stuff like that. It's not a fun experience. But basically, I got to a point to where I saw that oxycodone was doing nothing more than stopping a withdrawal for me. So in September of 2017, I went to my doctor and said, look, take these pills back. I wake up in the morning and I take one when my stomach just water is coming out of me. You know what I mean? All I'm doing is stopping a withdrawal. I don't get any relief from this pain at all. And I just want low dose Vicodin. That's all. That's all I need. It'll actually work when I need it. And I don't need to be an addict. And she's like, well, you know, it's going to make you really sick. And I'm like, I'm already getting really sick. Every day I wake up, I'm like sick until I take a pill. And it's supposed to be for pain. So she wouldn't take the pills back. Well, I can't take pills in a pill form, she tells me. So, you know, I got some water with me, so I poured it in the pill bottle. I shook it up and down. I was like, now it's mush. Can you? So she took it and threw it away. And I had no idea the type of withdrawal I was going to go through. After about 2 years of taking it, and I was taking about a third of what I was prescribed. So I was taking 2 pills a day and prescribed 6. And
were you weaned off of it, or just immediately, abruptly taken?
I just quit.
Taken a...
I gave them back. No.
That's dangerous,
and
isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I had cannabis oil, though. So the cannabis oil kicked in. It stopped the heavy, heavy withdrawal that would cause seizures. It allowed me to sleep. It eased me away from it. But still, I wrote a blog at 4 a.m. withdrawing from it, like 10 days into the withdrawal. It was an incredible withdrawal to have to go through, and we have to look at this and say, well, look, cannabis doesn't do this to us. Somebody that quits smoking cannabis 10 days later might not be a happy person. They could be very grumpy, but they're certainly not going to be at risk for seizing to death, for not eating, they're not going to go through a heroin type of withdrawal. What we're looking at now for people that are sitting on the fence as far as cannabis use is, especially in legal states, is you got a choice. You can use what's been made available to you, and what people have said, hey, look, this works, or you can continue down the pharmaceutical path. If that's working for you, continue down the pharmaceutical path. I mean, if chemotherapy is your decision for cancer, by all means, do it. It's very dangerous. People should know that, you know, I own a stake in a nutrient company. It's part of CISPE's many different corporations, MDX Grow. We have nutrients for growing big ag and cannabis. And so anyway, the only reason I bring that up is the nutrients have nitrogen in them, and nitrogen comes from bombs. The only reason we know about nutrients is because a bunch of bombs from World War II were stuck on a huge field. They didn't know what to do with them after the war. So they stuck them out on a huge, ugly, nasty field. Those containers and stuff started leaking, and suddenly that field became green and lush. So we figured out how to put stuff on plants that grow vegetables and fruits and stuff that we eat from the leakage of bombs. That is
so basically everything is contaminated then.
Everything is. Chemotherapy itself, many people do not know, stems from mustard gas. In both World War One, in World War One, it was obvious that groups that came back exposed from mustard gas were not getting cancer. So in World War II, they actually did studies to look at it heavily, at how many troops that were exposed. Then they started exposing troops. And many know about the multiple different mind control studies and stuff that were done by our government in the 40s and 50s and even 60s. And in these different studies, it's just incredible what was done, the exposure to all these different elements. But the biggest thing was mustard gas. And although it would kill people, it did not allow any cancer to grow and would actually eradicate cancers and tumors. Is the origin for chemotherapy. Anybody using chemotherapy should know this. You're getting low-level mustard gas. I'll go get it when I get a PET in a couple of weeks to see how cancer is doing. I mean, it's the only way to look is using an isotope tracer. So I do have to subject myself to the testing that's dangerous. So just to test to see where your cancer's at.
Do you do your own testing, or are you saying you go to a doctor this testing?
No, I have to go back to the cancer center. I was just referred back. I mean, after beating four cancers, I'm looking at the fifth one now. But the thing about it is this fifth one's been going on for a couple of years. It's just been misdiagnosed several times.
And now, does your doctor concur with you that it's the THC and CBD that's helped you with your defeating
this
cancer?
This particular doctor, my primary care doctor I have right now, has on and off been my primary care since 2011, and at one time was a prescriber of those 62 pills a day. So when I need to order labs, this doctor tends to hand over the lab order form to me and ask what else I want, and then I check the boxes and write on the lab order slip. I'll let her know. As far as imaging goes, she just sends me over to the Cancer Treatment Center, of course, and then I'll let them know. You know, I'm very forceful with doctors. I do not believe that we should be acting like some kind of, I don't know, the way people act around doctors blows my mind. When you take your car in for a tune-up, you sit and tell the mechanic who you're paying what you want done. You want to see your old, you know, spark plugs, right? You want your old stuff back. You know, you want an estimate. You know, you're going to go spend $120 or $150 or maybe $200. You want to know all this information on your car. But you go in with your body to the doctor's office, it costs the same thing. You have insurance, it's paying the same amount, yet you are a slave to this person telling you what to do, and you're spending money there. So when I go to the doctor, I'm a consumer, and I let my doctor know right away, these are the medications I'm using. I'm using this much oil, that much oil. Then I want it printed out. The next time I see that doctor, I want to see my records. I want to make sure cannabis oils are listed as my medications. If they're not, the doctor's fired. I'm done. And I'm moving on to another doctor. I have dealt with so many doctor errors, it's incredible. I personally have had cancers called in remission that were not. I've had blood tests that were read wrong, on and on, to the point to where my own life was jeopardized by doctors so many times that I've had to become literally the manager of anybody who's going to be my healthcare provider.
Mike, that's the next topic we want to cover. We're at the bottom of the hour, so we're going to do another song. But after the song, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about meds that we're taking from Big Pharma and how to transfer to cannabinoids. And that will be our topic when we come back from this song from Heaven's Face. It's a little bit of rock, a little bit of, well, you'll hear. It's Heaven's Face.
Now is the time for us to come together in mind. We're all floating in heaven. What are we fighting? Choose then.
Heaven's Face, that's right. We're a planet floating around in heaven's face. We're in space floating around. Our galaxy's traveling so fast, so many other galaxies, we can't even count them. But what we can count is our guest tonight, and we have Mr. Mike Robinson, who is an expert in cannabis. And tonight we're talking about every aspect of it, the pros, the cons, the myths, the truths. And right now we're going to discuss people who have been hooked on Big Pharma for so long, and now with medical marijuana legal in many states, how we make the transition from Big Pharma to the natural plant. Mike, what's your approach to that? Do we wean ourselves slowly, or do we just jump in the deep end and quit one and start the other?
There's two words that come to mind immediately. Very carefully. That's how we proceed. Anytime that you are taking a pharmaceutical medication, suddenly quitting it is not a good idea. You know, I talked about discontinuing a pain medication earlier. It's not a good idea to suddenly quit any type of pain medication until you know how the cannabinoid medicine that you're using is working. Whether you're using a full-spectrum THC oil or you're using a CBD oil, whether you're smoking or inhaling through vape pens or what have you, you need to know how it's working first. And how I quit was pretty interesting, and I share this with just about everybody that wants to quit. As you use the cannabis medicines, you start forgetting to take your own. You start looking at, I mean, I started going back and going, oh, wow, I forgot the afternoon dose, and it's 8 o'clock at night. So now I was like, okay, I'm just going to go 2 more hours and take my night dose. Okay, so what happened was entire dosages in like I had 4 different dose times a day. So entire different slots of medicine would get missed. And over a period of a couple months, those slots got bigger and bigger. And sometimes it'd get to the point to where I'd open them and say, okay, this one I need, that one. And I was starting to feel that, okay, for example, I take Valium. I take diazepam. To this day, I still take that medication. I have severe PTSD and severe anxiety. So, and I spread this message all the time. My belief is in integrative medicine. That means we integrate what we already have with the plant. We can't just go solo suddenly. I mean, we can, but that takes a lot of knowledge. And it takes a lot of resources. You know, so as I integrated the plant with the medicines that worked, the ones that didn't work, some of them caused withdrawal, heavy withdrawal. So I had to use stronger THC oils. THC oils tend to knock the person down, you know, I mean, to the point to where you're laying there doing Netflix binge watching, you know, and you're pretty happy and laughing. So the fact that you're missing this medication or missing that medication doesn't really matter. And you're able to get through that first 10 days of withdrawal and then start backing the THC oil down to a smaller dose, because you're probably going to keep using it. And see, this is one thing that I share with a lot of people is that you know, when we talk about discontinuing pharmaceuticals, remember that you're replacing them. So until you know you have a solid supply, until you know that's going to continue, you be very careful. You may slowly cut down. A lot of times the advice I give to people, and they're asking, like, how do I wean? I love everything you have to say, but how? I'll give them my recipes. And what I used to do quite often was take 10% or 20% of my dose every 5 days and reduce it. So if I took 1,000 milligrams and went by 20%, 5 days later, whatever pill that was, now I'm only taking 800 milligrams. You know, 5 days after that, I'm only taking 600. So I would use that 20% on the actual dose I started on, not continually as I broke down. So if it was a pill that, for example, was 1,000 milligrams, just to make it a round number, you know, for 5 days, I would keep it the same as I use the oil to take over for that medicine. Then I would drop it, and I would drop it. So I had literally a five-week period of time of dropping the medicine down. It's a very safe way to wean off a medication without promoting a seizure or promoting some type of withdrawal that's very uncomfortable. Now, for me particularly, I dump the medication. I have severe refractory epilepsy. There's two different types of epilepsy, either severe refractory or severe intractable. They affect 30% of the population of people with epilepsy, and no medication works for us. I had gone through 27 pharmaceuticals for seizures. I was taking 8 different prescriptions, 48 pills a day, when CBD and cannabis together, eating together, started working. So when I got the full extract black oil to get rid of pills, believe me, I got rid of them quick. But I did go through a little bit of withdrawal, but not much. You know, for the most part, I did that Netflix thing. I watched the entire Lost series. And, you know, I laughed a lot. I got my life back. So what I went through made sense, but I did it smart. And, you know, I've done videos about this. There's a couple up on YouTube where I warn people about weaning because I've seen people die. You've got to be very careful. You don't want to discontinue the wrong drug immediately, especially if you don't have the oil. I mean, I watch people all the time. They get something in the mail, and immediately I got a message from them on Facebook Messenger or somewhere. Oh, I just got oil today. How do I quit taking my Dilantin? Well, that affects their mood. You know. So we got to be.
Oh, what a wonderful place it would be. Just look around at reality.
I don't know what to do at this point. It sounds as if nothing is coming through the air. It sounds as if we've gone dead, as if the show just stopped. So